This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I want to just talk a lot about the concept of self-image. The effect, the extent to which one's own self-image affects one's behavior and one's adjustment in the world. For us, that's also important. Self-image will have dramatic effect on the way we operate. And really, as I said, as the shiur that was to be was not to be, all I'm here to do with you is learn a Mishnah. But we need a little bit of introduction to that first. There's an amazing medrash regarding Avraham's first sight of the three angels that came to call upon him. The angels were Michael, Raphael, and Gabriel, three very important malachim. They appeared to Avraham, says Rabbi Levi, one bidmus salki, one was in the appearance of a baker, the echod bidmus navti, one was in the appearance of a sailor, the echod bidmus arovi, and one was in the appearance of an Arab. So they didn't look a very exalted group of people. Omar, he said, one needs to understand that despite Avraham's open house and open-mindedness, he didn't treat everybody the same. They used to have to undergo some rigorous tests before they were admitted, certainly into the deeper recesses of his home. Imroya ani shishchino mamtenes aleihem. If I see that the shchino will wait for them, Avraham was busy talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam as they appeared, and he sees these visitors and he says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, hang on a little while, I just need to attend to the visitors. And this he does not only because that's the din, that Hachnasas Orchim comes before Kabbalas Pnei Hashchina, but also as a test of the greatness of his visitors. If the Shechina disappears as they come closer, then he knows that they weren't worthy. But if the Shechina waits around, if the Shechina hovers around and waits there while he attends to them, Ani yodea shehem bnei odom gedolim, then I know that they are great people. V'imani roye oisom chulkim kovud elu leelu, and if in addition I see them honoring one another, Ani yodea shehem bnei odom muhugonim, I know that they are also nice people, they are also good people, fine people, muhugonim. Kivan shiro isom chulkin kovid elu leelu, and when he saw them giving kovid one to another, yodo shehim bnei hodom muhugonim, he knew that they were fine people. Very frightening medrash. It is possible to have a group of people who are great, and great not in terms of what the University of the Witwatersrand considers great, and not great in terms of what a Rosh Hashiva considers great, but godel in terms of what the Shechina considers great. That the Ribbono Shel Olam Shechina hovers around, it doesn't move off, it waits there, while Avraham attends to them. And Avraham uses that as a test of their godliness, and they pass that test. That's how great they are, and yet they can be Bnei Adam She'ena Mehugonim, they're not nice people. This is something, in fact, which is a shock to many people who first become religious. People who've been religious all their lives become used to the fact that Torah Yiddishkeit is a big society, it's a big world, and like every other society, it has its saints and it has its rogues. And it is. That's how it is. There's no guarantee that just because a person is frum that he's not a rogue. That's something that one grows up with and understands. But about Shuva, who comes to Torah through idealism, he identifies it in its magnificence, in its purposefulness, in its beauty, in its tzidkus. That's what attracts him to it. He doesn't need anything of it. He wasn't born that way. He wasn't raised that way. But when he sees what the Torah is all about, what it has to offer, how it analyzes life, what it demands of people, and he comes into contact with certain people and he sees greatness, and he gives up everything, he gives up his entire lifestyle to become attracted to that. And he goes through an interesting state. He goes up and up and up in ecstasy. And inevitably, after a year, 2 years, 3 years, there's an incredible drop. Disillusionment. He comes across his first encounter with a frum rogue, and it shakes him too terribly. And he doesn't know what to do with himself. This medrash is perhaps one of the first medrashim that a person should learn when he becomes involved in Yiddishkeit. It can be. One can have a person who's not only frum, but who's an odom godel, who's great, who has expertise, who's great in terms of the Ribbono Shel Olam's definitions even, but he's not mehuga, not a fine person, not an edel image. Can be such a thing. Avraham wanted them to pass both tests, which they did. Not only is the Torah no guarantee to refinement, but in fact it can be a disturbance to refinement. That's an even greater shock. Not only is there no guarantee that if you do, all you have to do is learn Torah and practice the mitzvahs and you'll be a finer mensch, not only is there no such guarantee, but there is in fact a danger that before you were a finer mensch, now there can be a problem, or at least you were neutral either way. Now the Torah can in fact make you worse. Or let's not put it that way. Let's say that if you were not a finer mensch to start with, there's a possibility that the Torah will make you even worse. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says in Baal Yisachar and Perik Yud Aleph, after the Bnei Israel complain again that they've got no food, and the Ribbono Shel Olam gives them Musar, and he says, Yam ki ma'astem es Hashem asher bekir bechem, because you have repelled, you've been repelled by the Ribbono Shel Olam who is in your midst. Vativku lefon of lemur, and you have cried before him saying, Lomo ze yotzonu mitzrayim, why did we go out of Mitzrayim? Says Rashi, Im loy shenotati shchinosi beineichem, if it weren't that I implanted my shchino between you, loy govo levavchem likones lechol advarim halolu, you would never have got so arrogant to do all these things. It's because of the godly presence which is within you that you've got the arrogance to be able to do that which you've done. If you take a person who's bad material to start off with, and you increase the level of kedusha, it gives him more reason to be bad. It gives him more reason to be arrogant. It doesn't remove the arrogance. There's no natural medicine here that removes the arrogance. And that's why the Gemara says, Sama chayim l'mayiminim bo, and sama mavis l'masmirim bo. If one learns the Torah with one's right hand, whatever that means, we won't get into the Chazal at this time, the Torah is a samachayim, it's a life-giving potion. But if you learn with your left hand, it's samamoves, it's poison. It actually becomes destructive. As one increases one's Torah knowledge, so is one destroying oneself more and more and more. It's a frightening thought, but it is so. If you take a man who has no appreciation of human life, and a low sense of responsibility, and you give him a motor car to drive, he's going to kill people. Does that mean motor cars are bad things? No, that means a motor car in the hands of an irresponsible person is a bad thing. Give people guns. Is a gun a bad thing? No, a gun is a wonderful thing, it protects people. But a gun in the hand of an irresponsible person is a murderous weapon. The Torah is no less powerful. Torah in the hands of an unfit person is totally destructive. Samamovis. Because the Shekhinah is amongst you, you had the arrogance to do this. That in itself gave you the arrogance. We have a warning in that Rashi. Torah has within it the potential for the creation of arrogance. Whereas a person without Torah could be just a nice ordinary person. He goes around his business without a feeling of being anything special. And so whatever he is, he is. When he gets involved in Torah, he becomes in his own eyes. Here we come into the area of self-image, somebody of great self-importance, and that can result in tremendous destructiveness. And then we could in fact say that what Avraham was testing was not only to see if they gave honor one to the other, but if the Shekhinah being among them, they still gave honor one to another. Just giving honor one to another, that's one test. But let's see if the Shin, if they're the Neodim Gedolim, if they're great people and they give honor one to another, then they're Hagunim, then they really fit, then they're really something special. But that needs to be tested and that needs to be tried. The Telzer Rav says, how often will you find that in his day you will find Rosh Yeshivas, Rabbonim at a meeting, and all the tables around the chair are taken, and a person comes in into the room, and it's the most embarrassing moment. A person that comes into a room where things are already in motion, at a meeting, at a simcha, at a dinner, it's bad manners if there's no reason for his being late. But sometimes he's an honest, there's nothing he can do, he's late, and he comes in and he looks around and he doesn't know quite, and he sees there's nowhere to sit. It's the most embarrassing moment. So it tells the Rav, who will inevitably get up and give him the chair? The greatest. For the ones who are not great, it says, who is he to give up? I must give up my chair for him. It's the greatest inevitably that will give up the chair for the newcomer. To see a person who is a godel, to see a person who is great in his field of expertise, and yet is also chulkim kovod eilu leilu, they give honor one to another. That's a very great thing to see, and that's a very special thing to see. That's bnei odom mehugonim. That's point number one. Point number two. The halacha, the Shulchan Aruch, defines what constitutes a rav muvhak. I want to know, does one have a Rav Muvak? Or who is one's Rav Muvak? Rav Muvak means one's primary Rebbe, one's primary teacher, for which there are certain halachas. There are certain halachas for any teacher, and there are certain particular halachas for a Rav Muvak. The halacha defines a Rav Muvak as a Rav who has taught one most of one's knowledge, most of one's Torah is taught one, that's a Rav Muvak. Was the Ramos says also one who has given a gisha, is given an approach to understanding of Torah, is given one the basic approach which one uses then for the rest of one's life, that's a Rav Muvak. What is a Talmud? How do you define a Talmud? You might think it's the same, obviously. If A is B's Rav Muvak, then B is A's Talmud. But it doesn't always work like that. There's a certain person who claims to be the Talmud of a very great Rosh Yeshiva. And I could never understand, and he always quotes this Rosh Yeshiva, and he knows his stuff, there's no question about it, but something didn't click. So I asked one of the other Talmidim of that Rosh Yeshiva, I said, is it true that Mr. X was a Talmid of the Rosh Yeshiva? He says, no, the Rosh Yeshiva was his Rebbe, but he wasn't the Talmid of the Rosh Yeshiva. I said, what do you mean and how do you know? He said, well, he was to be in the Shirim, he never missed a Shir. And it's true that he knows the Rosh Yeshiva's Torah very well. If you need to know something, he can quote it by heart and he has all the notes, he knows it very well. But I should just tell you that when he used to walk into the room, the Rosh Yeshiva used to get up and lock the doors of his cupboards. Just that everybody should have very clear who he's dealing with. There you have an example of a person who has a Rav Muvhak, but his Rav doesn't consider him as a Talmid. This we see expressed in the Mishnah that I want to learn with you. Mishnah says in Perich Hamishi of Pirkei Avos, Kol mi sheyesh boi shloisho dvorim halolu, anybody who has within him the following three attributes, mi talmidov shel Avraham Avinu, he is a talmid of Avraham Avinu, ushloisho dvorim acherim, and the three opposites, mi talmidov shel Bilam Harosha, he's a talmid of Bilam. So here we're going to see already how the Mishnah defines a Talmid. We're not talking about whose Rebbe he was, we're talking about who are the Talmidim. Ayin Toiva, the good eye, the Ruach Nemucha, and a lowly spirit, difficult terms to translate, the Nefesh Shfela, and a modest Nefesh, Mitalmidov shel Avraham Avinu. They are of the Talmidim of Avraham Avinu. Ayin ro, a bad eye. The Ruach Gevoyah, a high spirit. The Nefesh Rechova, and a broad Nefesh. Mitalmidov shel Bilam Arosha. He's of the Talmidim of Bilam Arosha. The Mishnah gives this as the only distinction of the Talmidim of the two different schools. That means imagine that the two schools would exist at the same time, which they do, because in any generation you can have Talmidim of the one or Talmidim of the other. Imagine if in Johannesburg we had the yeshiva of Avraham Avinu and we had the yeshiva of Bilam. You walk into one, you walk into the other. The Mishnah is telling us what we will notice different. We would think, having read this week's parsha, what did you notice different? The question is, what would you notice the same? Firstly, in the one you'll come, you'll see a Rosh Hashiva, Avraham Avinu. Can you imagine seeing Avraham Avinu sitting up at the front? The beauty of the sight of it, the Hadrasponim, the greatness of Avraham Avinu, his long black coat and a long white beard. Going to the yeshiva of Bilam, who are you going to see there sitting? Bilam with his donkey, what are you going to see? And the Talmidim, can you imagine what goes on in Bilam's yeshiva, what goes on in Avraham's yeshiva? No comparison. In Avraham's yeshiva, they'll be learning Gemara, they'll be learning Tanakh, they'll be learning Mishnayos, they'll be learning Halacha, they'll be learning Midrashi. What will they be learning in Bilam's yeshiva? The art of cursing, what are they going to be learning there? Says the Mishnah, you're mistaken. If you go in, you will find no difference except these three things. The Rosh Hashivas will look similar, the Talmidim will look similar, they'll be learning the same, there'll be only these three things are going to be different. Ayin Teva, a good eye, you'll have to get an optician in to notice the differences. The Ruach Nemucha or Ruach Gevaya, whether the spirit is high or low, the Nefesh Shvela, three Midas. You'll have to analyze these people very carefully to notice the differences between the Talmidim sitting in the rows of the Beis HaMedrash of Avraham's Yeshiva and the Talmidim sitting in the rows of the Beis HaMedrash of Bilam's Yeshiva. One will have to be very discerning and very perceptive to pick up these differences. As an aside, that shows one how careful one has to be. Imagine a person decides he wants to spend a couple of years in Yeshiva. He goes around looking how easily he could land up in Bilam's Yeshiva. Well, you know the difference. They learn just as well, Hasmod is just as good. Everything's the same except these three midas. When you hear people choosing a yeshiva to go to, how often do you hear them using these three as the criterion to decide whether I should go there or not? You'll say to a person, why did you choose that yeshiva? He says, because the Hasmoda was good, they learn nicely, they don't waste time. Good, very nice. Why did you choose that yeshiva? Because the type of, whatever it is, you'll find different reasons why they chose that particular yeshiva. The reason doesn't mean that you're sitting in a yeshiva Bila Marosha. How do you know? These are the three things that would have to be analyzed to know whether you're rubbing shoulders with the Talmidim of Avraham Avinu or you're rubbing shoulders with the Talmidim of Bila. What are the three things? Before we go into the three things, says the Rambam, and because of this, anybody who has these three attributes will be considered mitalmidov shel Avraham Avinu, of the Talmidim of Avraham Avinu, mipnei shehisnaheg b'midosov, because he conducts himself in accordance with the midos of Avraham Avinu. V'chol mi sheyimotzu bo ele shloisha pechituyos, and anybody in whom you find these three degeneracies, who mitalmidov shel Bilam, is of the Talmidim of Bilam Arosho, acha shehisnaheg b'midosov, since he followed the characteristics of Bilam. Here in this Rambam we have the definition of what constitutes a Talmid. What constitutes a Rebbe, we know. Anybody who taught you most of your wisdom, he is your Rebbe. But who is my Talmid? Who is your Talmid? How do you define a Talmid? Somebody who sits in the shir? No! If he's Hilich B'midosov, that's all. If the Torah which molded the character of the Rosh Yeshiva molds the character of the Talmid in the same type of mold, in the same sort of direction, then you know he's a Talmid, he's learning the same Torah. But if he comes out completely different, if the Rosh Hashiva is the height of integrity, and when the Talmid walks in, he locks all the cupboards, the Rosh Hashiva locks all the cupboards, how are you going to explain that? And yet the Talmid knows all the Torah he's learnt, it's true he's learnt. But it's had no effect on him, so what he's been learning has not been the same Torah. He's been learning it in a different way, he's been learning it superficially, he knows the tricks. But what he's learnt is not the same Torah, for if it was the same Torah, it would have affected him the same way. Affected him the same way doesn't mean that all the Talmidim would become clones of the Rabbeim, Chas v'Sholem, that not at all. But they would have within them certain basic characteristics, which that Rosh Hashiva would regard as a sine qua non, that's the basis of Torah. Anybody who has, says the Rambam, these three qualities can be considered a Talmid of Avraham Avinu. Anybody who has the other three is a Talmud of Bilam. What about their wisdom? It makes no difference. The Talmud of Bilam might know the whole of Shas. The Talmud of Avraham Avinu might only know one Masechta. That's not what qualifies you. That's not what defines you. The Talmud of Bilam might have been learning for 50 years. The Talmud of Avraham Avinu might have been learning for 1 year. That's not what qualifies you. What's important is the Rambam. Are you going in the midst of your Rebbe Avraham Avinu or are you not? Are you going in the midst of Bilam or are you not? That's what will define whose Talmud you are. That's where you look. You look at the individual's conduct, not at his knowledge, in order to determine whose Talmud he is. What are the three middos? Firstly, Ayin Toivah. There are differences in the Mefarshim as how exactly to explain these three middos. But in the end it works out very similar. Ayin Toivah, Rashi defines, She'ein loy kino al chaveiroi, v'choviv olov kovid chaveiroi kichvedev. He is not jealous of his friend, and the honor of his friend is as valuable to him as it is to himself. That's the definition of the first midah, Ayin Toiva. Ruach Nemucho. And by the way, that we learn from Avraham Avinu by the tremendous chesed that he used to do. Ruach Nemucho. That's a person who doesn't consider himself to be all that great. As Avraham Avinu said, V'anoichi ofer ve'efer. What am I? I'm talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Who am I? I'm dust and ashes. We need to appreciate, though, that Avraham said that when he was speaking to the Ribbono Shel Olam. When he was speaking to the king of Sodom, he didn't use the same kind of language. Who am I? And I'm nobody to be telling you what to do. Then he was very firm. When we talk about Ruach Nemucha, it means an objective understanding of where I really hold, not pretending to be less than I am, just an objective understanding that compared to where I need to be, where I'm supposed to be, and who the Ribbono Shel Olam is and what he demands of me, I'm nowhere, I'm nothing. That's Ruach Nemucha. The Chofetz Chaim used to walk through his study and he used to look at the Sforim and he used to point Sefer after Sefer. New Chofetz Chaim used to say, do you know what's in this Sefer? Do you know what's in this Sefer? Do you know what's in this Sefer? So who are you exactly? The Chofetz Chaim used to do just to remind himself. That didn't stop him from being attacky, from being strong and assertive in his viewpoint. Because he knew very well when he was dealing with others that they didn't know much more than him. That wasn't the point. But in relation of his own objective standards, that which he expects from himself and that which the Ribbono Shel Olam expects from him, who are you? That's Ruach Nemucha. Nefesh Shpelo, that's a middle of Istapkus, that's a middle of I've got as much as I need. I don't need any more than I've got. When Avraham said to the king of Sodom, you'll remember, I don't want anything from the a little thread to a shoelace, I need nothing. I've got enough. Those are the three middos. An absence of jealousy and a value of other people's honor, number one. Number two, a lowly spirit and a lack of arrogance. And number three, histapkus, a satisfaction with what one has. The opposite is in the case of Bilam, and we learn that all from our posuk, from our psukim in the Seder of today. Bilam, did he have an ayin tova? No. When he saw the beauty of the camps of Israel, it's true that he gave a brocha, but he gave that brocha against his will. That's not what he really wanted to do. He wanted to give them an ayin hora. He wanted to kiss them. He wanted to look at them. It bothered him to see such nachas among the Yiddish people. It bothered him tremendously. That's the ayin ra. It's the bad eye. And the ruach nemucha he doesn't have. He's got a ruach gavoya, the high spirit. Is when he says to the messengers that were sent to him, the Ribbono Shel Olam won't let me go with you people. I need greater offices, higher offices than you, before the Ribbono Shel Olam will allow me to go with you. The nefesh v'chover, and his wide nefesh, is when he said, even if Balak will give me his whole house, his whole palace, full of gold, I still won't go with him. Chazal woke up from there that he felt that's what he was entitled to. The invoice he would have said and sent, the statement he would have sent at the end of the month, that would have been your house full of gold. That's how he viewed his own worth and certainly what he was after in terms of financial gain. It's interesting to see that the two are up, that it goes opposite all the way except for the last one. Ayin Toiva, Ayin Roa, good eye, a bad eye. Ruach Nemucha, a lowly spirit. Ruach Gevoya, a high spirit. The last one is Nefesh Shvela, a lowly Nefesh. And in the case of Bilam, Nefesh Lechova, a wide Nefesh. I think the reason is, a Nefesh Shvela, if one's needs, the Nefesh is one's physical needs, one's material needs. If they are low down, what does that mean? If it's low down, then you can be sure of one thing. Whatever is available has flown in already to me. If I consider my needs as low down, lower than everything else, then it's all come my way already. Whatever I don't have is not available to me. That's the pshat in Nefesh Shvela. It's low down. The opposite of that is Nefesh Rechova. Makes no difference whether it's low, whether it's high. It's very, very broad. When something is very, very wide, even when you put a lot into it, it doesn't cover the bottom yet. The needs are very great. He has needs. Now, Avraham Avinu, it doesn't matter how great his needs are. That's not what's important. What's important is, whatever is available to me, I'm sure the Ribbono Shel Olam has given. What he hasn't given is not available to me. That's the end of the story. We don't crave for things that we know are not available to us. We only crave for things which are just about within our reach or just beyond our reach. But if we know it's right out of possibility, we don't crave for it. Nobody craves for his own ocean liner. Nobody craves for his own Boeing. You know, not ordinary people like us. We crave for a little bit more of the kind of thing we've got, a little bit better than the kind of thing we've got. Avraham Avinu had a Nefesh Shvela. He knew whatever he needed, whatever was available to him, he's got. Whatever he doesn't have is not available. Bilam Arosho has a Nefesh Rechova. His needs are very great, and whatever he's got is not yet sufficient. That's the Nefesh Rechova. Why doesn't Avraham Avinu test these three visitors with all three tests? Why is he satisfied with the one test? He says he wants to see if they're chilkin kovid zeloze, which according to Rashi is the first test of ayin toiva. Are they mean with one another, or are they generous with one another's kovid? The truth is that if you have the two, you have the third. Let's look at it carefully. Ayin Toiva and Ayin Ro is the only one where a value judgment is given in the descriptive word itself. A good eye and a bad eye. The other is a high spirit, a low spirit, a lowly nefesh and a wide nefesh. It doesn't tell us which is good and which is bad. We have to work it out. But in the first one, Ayin Toiva and Ayin Ro. The Ayin is the way you look at other people. The eye is the way you look outwards. And there's such a thing as a good eye and a bad eye, and it's as simple as that. And that's where you define the degree to which a person is hogun or not, the way he looks at others. We started off talking about self-image. We'll see where self-image fits in a moment. But really what we have to analyze is the eye. I mentioned in a shiur the other day that when the doctors want to see if somebody's dead or alive, they look in the eye. And not only to see if they're dead or alive. Apparently the eye can give them all sorts of information, quite unconnected with vision, or quite beyond vision alone. The eye is their ability to see deep down into what's going on in the inside of the skull, what's going on in the brain. They can see all amazing things by a careful analysis of the eye. So it is with us. In the eye you see it all. In the eye you'll see an eye in Tevo and an eye in Ro, and from there you know. It says, Avraham Avinu, that's all I want to see with these three people. An eye in Tevo and an eye in Ro. How do they look at one another? I'm not interested in how they look at me. I want to know how they look at one another. Let's look at the other two midas. Ruach Gevoya is arrogance, and Nefesh Rechova is big needs. You have two kinds of people. Arrogance is what I think of myself. Here we have the self-image. Nefesh is what I think of my needs, what I have, what I possess. You have one man who says, I am very great and I don't have enough. You have another man who says, I am very small and I have as much as I want. I have too much. Those are the two ways. Let's look at it carefully. A person who is modest says, who am I? Off of wafer, I'm nothing. The fact that I might be greater than any other living being, so what? That doesn't mean very much. Taking a university professor and putting him in a nursery school and saying, ooh, professor, you're the cleverest person here today. Do you know that, professor? Well, does it make him feel good? It's nothing, it's unimportant. I want to know what I am among people of my own standard. I want to know how my peers look upon me. I want to know how my superiors look upon me. I want to know what the Ribbono Shel Olam thinks of me, not what all these idol worshippers around me think. That's not what I'm interested in. Avraham Avinu might have well have known that he was the most outstanding person of his time, but still when he talks to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Anochi Ofer Ve'efer, in my own eyes I'm Ofer Ve'efer, I'm dust and ashes, I'm nothing. In that case, if I'm nothing, what about what I possess? What I possess, I don't deserve it. Where does it all come from? I've got more than I need. And that's not only in physical possessions, but also in talent, in ability. If I consider myself unworthy, then I consider myself gifted. The true word, the true meaning of the word gifted. A gift is something you've been given for no reason, without payment. A talent is a slightly different word. A gift means that you've been given something for which you didn't pay, something you don't deserve. The acknowledgement of my own giftedness is an acknowledgement of my own undeservedness and my own inadequacy. And the two go together. To say that I am nothing and I am extremely gifted means I am terribly fortunate. I am being given much more than I deserve and much more than I need. That's one type of self-image. That's the image of the modest person. The modest person is not I am nothing and I have nothing. The modest person is I am nothing and I have so much, Ribbono Shel Olam. So much you've given me. How can I repay you? What can I do with all this that you've given me? The arrogant person? Oh, who am I? I'm the cat's whiskers. And what have I got? Whatever I've got is insufficient for me. That's not. The two must go together. The more you think you are, the less you must think of what you've got in relationship to what you are. The less you think of, the less you think you are, the more you must think of what you have. And here we see the Torah's requirements of self-image. To be low on what you've, on what you are, and consequently high on what you have. Not the Christian idea of modesty is low on both. I am nothing and I've got nothing and I'm worth nothing. How can one operate in the world if that's what you believe of yourself? If you've got nothing, you are nothing, so what? So commit suicide. Why bother the world with your presence any further? That's not the way we are. The way we've got to be is, I am nothing, but somehow the Ribbono Shel Olam is expecting great things of me. I don't know why. He's given me things which I have to use, I have to do something with. What I've got far exceeds my worth. The other one is, what I am far exceeds what I've got. Why has he given me so little? Why am I always suffering so much? Why have others got more than I have? And those two will give the third middah. Consequently, if I consider myself to be more, if I consider myself to be little, and my abilities and possessions to be great, what am I going to have? An Ayin Tova. Ayin Tova and Ayin Ra really is just a measure of what's happening with the light waves. Are they going from the eye outward, or are they going from outward to the eye? The eye is a window. The question is, what is the window being used for? Is it being used to look out, or is it being used to look in? An Ayin Tova is a person who's looking out. He's got too much for himself. He's nothing after all. He's nobody. So what he's got is already too much for him. So what's he looking for now? Opportunity to use what he's got. Opportunity to allow it to overflow. Opportunity to give others of it. To allow others to benefit of what he's got. Because he doesn't deserve it all. It's quite clear to him that the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't give it to him because of himself. Because he wanted him to have it. So why did the Ribbono Shel Olam give it to him? Because he wants him to channel it to others. So he's got to look. He uses his eyes to see, where can I do? What can I give? Where can I take responsibility? Where can I offer myself? That's Ayin Tova. When the eye is being used correctly as a means of looking out. And then you've got the other person who sees himself as a big man, and consequently as what he's got as not enough. What's he looking for? What can I have? What can I take? And it's amazing that whereas we recognize this so quickly in some areas, we fail to recognize it in others. You get a person who walks into your shop and he's got shifty eyes and he's looking around at everything, and already you start getting nervous and you try and get him out as quickly as you can. He hasn't come to buy. He hasn't come to give you some legitimate profit for the effort you've made to give him a service. He's come to chap as much as he can for as low a price as he can. Get him out. Come, you see a different person comes with an Ayin Tova. He admires your merchandise. He likes what you've got. He would like to purchase some. That's the person you do business with. We recognize it straight away. Intuitively we see an Ayin Tova and an Ayin Ra. But in the more subtle areas we find it more difficult to identify. And it isn't more difficult. Just look at the eyes. In the eye you'll straight away see, is this a contributor or is this a taker? Is this somebody here who's here for a free trip, or is this somebody here who's here to make a contribution? And once you have that, you've got all the other 3 meters, the other two meters as well. Once you know this is a man who's here to make a contribution, why is he here to make a contribution? Because he considers that what he's got is more than he deserves. So you know he's got a ruach nemucha and a nefesh shvelo, and you know he's a talmid of Avraham Avinu. What greater credentials could you want than that? To do business with him, to create a friendship with him, to learn chavrusa with him, to take him as a talmid, to take him as a rebbe. What greater credentials could there be? And it's so easy to identify. If you see he's not, he's there to take a free trip, he's there to take, not to give. And you've got to figure out why, because he considers that he hasn't got enough. You owe him something. Why do you owe him something? Because he considers himself very great, and what he's got is not sufficient. So he's got a ruach gevoya and a nefesh rechova, keep away from him, he's a talmid of Bilam. And we've seen what kind of a man Bilam is, and we know how to keep our distances from such people. All we don't know is how to recognize their talmidim. To recognize Bilam may not be so difficult. If you see a man in a long black coat and a big hat with a long white beard driving on a she-ass, keep away. That might be Bilam. Not that difficult to see Bilam. But his talmidim didn't drive on the she-ass. They drove in ordinary motor cars. And it's a little bit more difficult to identify them, says the Mishnah. All you do is look at the eye. Are these people who are takers or are they givers? If they're takers, keep away from them. If they're givers, you be makar of them, you get close to them. Where does this midah come from? Sorry, just before we go further, the easiest test we see from Avraham Avinu, how do you really test? Look at their eyes. Not always that easy. Sometimes they wear dark glasses, which is already a bit of a chashash. But where they don't, says Avraham Avinu, see how they treat their colleagues. See how they with one another. Are they chulking covered or not? There you'll know. A person who's chilek kovod, a person who gives honor to others, has tremendous self-security. He doesn't need, it doesn't threaten him. The man who gets up at the meeting to give his chair, because there's no vacant chair to the outsider who's just walked in, is the man who doesn't see that as a slight on his own stature. He doesn't feel people are going to think less of him because he doesn't have a chair or because he got up to give it to this person. He's confident. People know who I am, and it's going to make absolutely no difference whether if I give my chair or not. The other person who doesn't give his chair, why does he hold on to his benkel so hard? Because he feels that if he gives it up, people are going to say, look, he's giving up his chair for so-and-so. He can't be very much. So he feels insecure. Why does he feel insecure? There's nothing inside. The chulking kovod zelzeh is the greatest test. And that's why the einish for the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva was so severe. Great Talmidei Chachamim, here we have another example. Great Talmidei Chachamim, can you imagine? Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. 24,000 of them. Wiped out. For what reason? Lo hoyu chulking kovod zelzeh. That's all. They didn't do anything wrong. Doesn't mention any avera that they did. They just didn't do something right that they should have done. Chulking kovod zelzeh. They didn't show honor one to another. That's all. For that they're wiped out. Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. And we keep the Sfira period because of the effect that had on the world today. Had 24,000 people of that stature have survived then, it's not very difficult by mathematical calculation figure out if each one of them would have had, look, they're not all Rabbi Akivas, so they wouldn't have had 24,000 Talmidim each. Let's say each one would have had 5,000 Talmidim. And each of the 5,000 would have had another 5,000 Talmidim, and so on. Figure out what the world would have looked like today had those 24,000 people suffered. So that a lot of what we're going through today is because of the lack of those 24,000 people. Why were they destroyed? Midas, not for Torah. Why are you chulking kovod zelzeh? So severely does the Torah view that particular inadequacy. Where does it come from? The Maharal says one of the basic differences between Avraham Avinu and Bilam. See many chazals, we spoke on Friday night about one chazal, many chazals that compare Avraham Avinu and Bilam. Maharal says they were both fathers of the nations. Avraham was the father of the Yiddish nation, and through that of other nations as well. Bilam was the father of many of the Goyishka nations. The main difference between them, says the Maharal, is that Avraham used to drive a he-ass, and Bilam used to drive a she-ass. It's a very, very subtle difference. That's why I said, if you want to identify a Bilam, it's quite easy, but the only way you'll do it is not by what he looks like, because you might be fooled, he might look quite frum, The only way you'll be able to identify it is to see whether he's driving a male or a female ass. What's the difference? The Gemara says in Avodah Zarah and Avdalit that Bilam actually had sexual relations with his donkey. Be that as it may, one thing is sure, he had relations with his donkey. The Pashtus, we've got to take the Chazal quite literally. But that's not the subject of the Shir. The subject of the Shir is that they were connected with one another. They got on well. This relationship was more than just donkey and rider. And you see also from the donkey's talk to him. When Bilam tried to pretend in the presence of the Sorei Moav, when Bilam tried to pretend that this was just some donkey that he'd never seen before. Sometimes like when your car breaks down and you're with somebody that you've offered a lift, you try and pretend that you don't have much to do with this car. It just happens to be that way. It's really not your fault at all. So Bilam tried to get away with this donkey, and the donkey turned around and spoke. Can you imagine if you tried that, the car answered you back in front of your visitors? Excuse me, this is just a hired car, it's not my usual car. Imagine the car, excuse me, hired car. I've been with you for 15 years, and you haven't treated me very well either. That's what happened. And one sees, in fact, from that dialogue between the donkey and Bilam, that they had a very intimate relationship. That's for sure. Whereas Avraham Avinu rode a male donkey, there was no relationship between donkey and balabos at all. Other than that, he controlled the donkey and mastered the donkey and used him for transport. The word chamor and the word chimer are related. Chamor is the symbol that the Torah uses very often of materialism, because the donkey is the ultimate of materialism, really. Nebuchadnezzar, he has nothing to him except to carry goods around and to carry people around. He doesn't have much personality, he doesn't have much character. No, that's his very, very basic materialism, and he's called a chamor from the word chomer. What's important here is the relationship between Avraham and materialism, and Lahavdil Bilam and materialism, as represented by the donkey. Avraham used it. Bilam had an existential relationship with it. That's the difference. Avraham was able to drop it when necessary. Wait one second. I've got to go and do an Avodas Hashem on the mountain. You, the Na'arim and the donkey, you wait here. I don't need you. In fact, you will be a distraction to me. He's able to leave the Chomer behind. He's able to leave the materialism behind, elevate himself, and come back to it later on when he's finished. Bilam couldn't tear himself away from the donkey. He couldn't keep away from the donkey for a minute. He needed the donkey at all times, not only as a bearer of his goods or of his body. He needed the donkey for company also, for social company. He got on well with the donkey. The relationship between people and their pets is very indicative of the degree of decadence of the entire society. When in America you've got dog parlors started here already a long time ago, but when you've got dog psychiatrists and dog shaitchonim and marriage bureaus and all sorts of things already that they are there, where in the States it's become very serious that people have replaced children with dogs. There was such an anti-children campaign for the last 15 years or so, an anti-population campaign, and simultaneously and unconnected, there was a tremendous love your animals and anti-cruelty to animals campaign. So obviously things started happening. People started developing negative attitudes to children and positive attitudes to animals, and they switched place. And that's what happened to Bilam. His relationship with his donkey was it was a pet. It wasn't just an animal that had a job to do. He used the animal for comfort as well. He needed the animal. He needed comfort. We sometimes are able to laugh at the relationship between people and their pets. That's very good. But we have to understand that we sometimes use other material objects or materialism in general in the same way as the Americans use their pets. Sorry, Reuven, some Americans use their pets. To use materialism for Avodas Hashem, one has a job to do and one needs matter, one needs the material things with which to do the job, that's what it was created for. But to draw our comfort and our security from material things, that's when we run into difficulty. Let's examine what is the difficulty. Material things are not productive. And therefore, material things are always inadequate. They're never enough. if a person has developed the ability within himself to produce his own security, he has a good self-image of himself. When he's feeling low, he knows how to pull himself out of the low. He has within him the dynamics for his own spiritual and social survival. He's independent as a human being can be. When a person requires physical things for security, it's a never-ending process. What happens? He starts off, he's just finished university, without an income he feels insecure. What about bitochen? There's a ribbono shalom, there's a Torah. So you need a job, all very well, Torah, ribbono shalom. You've got to eat something at the end of the month. He finds a job, and he's happy. Baruch Hashem, at last, he's got enough to survive. And that lasts for about 1 month. Then he starts looking around, and it's no longer enough to survive on, because he needs to get married, he wants to establish a family. So he's got to crave it a little bit more. Craves a little bit more, and he gets a little bit more, and he's able to get married, and he has children, and he's now got enough to survive on. Why are you insecure? The house doesn't belong to him, it's a rented house. You know what that means? Any time the balabos can throw them out, the rents can go up, who knows what tomorrow is going to bring? He's got to work a little bit harder, he's got to get a little bit more money, his wife should start working, they've got to be able to buy a house. No good. Nothing wrong with buying a house, but his reason is the wrong reason. So he does so, and he's now earning a little bit more. And mazel and bracha, they're able to afford a house of their own, a big simcha. And now he's made it. He's got enough to bring up his children and to pay for their education. And he's got a home and he can cover the bond. And there's a little bit of money left over at the end of the month as well. All of a sudden he's insecure again. What now? You know, his children are going to have to get married. How's he going to afford their weddings? But there's still plenty of time. But he's getting insecure already. So he has to start saving. He's got to work a little bit harder for his savings. He saves. Going very nicely, each month he's able to put away 20, 30 rand, good. Now he's feeling happy again, family's secure, everybody's well. All of a sudden he's insecure again. What about retirement? He's going to have to retire one day. So he starts taking out retirement annuities and insurance policies. And now he's working and his wife is working and they're in debt as well to pay for all the security. Comes the time of retirement, at last you would think, no, 65 years old, now I can retire, I've provided, I can sit and learn a little bit, do the things I've always wanted to do and never had the time to do. No, inflation. My pension is enough today, is it going to be enough in 5 years' time? I must carry on working, I must get another job. So it goes the whole life. So what's he done? What's he achieved? What was the root of the insecurity? His financial difficulties, that wasn't the root of the insecurity. The root of the insecurity was that he depended on material things for security, that's all. And when you depend on material things for security, you get security from constant increase, not from a fixed amount. 1 million rand won't make a person secure. 10 million rand won't make a person secure. The achievement of 10 million rand will make him secure until he's used to it. And then he'll need more. And so it goes, no one dies having achieved half of his ambitions in the material sense. It's impossible. Whatever you want, you feel insecure unless you're getting more. A person who sees himself as off over Eifer, I'm nothing, and therefore what I've got is more than I deserve. That's the ultimate of security. I've already got more than I deserve, and therefore more than I need. I'm looking for opportunities to give it, to do something with it. I've got more than I need. Absolute security. It's not important how much you've got. Avraham was a wealthy man, as it happens. And one might say it's very easy for Avraham to be secure. Very easy for Avraham to have a nefesh shvela. But the Mishnah is made that it makes no difference. It's a nefesh shvela, whatever Avraham had, and he went through poor days as well. It made no difference to his security. Because he always considered himself less deserving than what he had. That's the key to security. To consider yourself less worthy than what you've got. And then you're happy. The other person, the nefesh, the bilam with the nefesh rechava and the ruach gevoya, that's the opposite. I'm great, and therefore unless my greatness is being recognized by constant salary increases, I feel insecure. That's the bilam arusha. Avraham Avinu was separate from the chaymer. He used the chamer, he used the donkey, and he used materialism for his service of the Ribbono Shel Olam, but not as a security blanket. That's not what he used it for. For that he didn't need it for. He was fully secure without anything material. Does that mean that he became a hermit and withdrew from everything material? No. He lived a normal physical life among normal people. But his relationship with his material world was not normal. His relationship with the material world was, I don't need you for security. I need you only for avodas Hashem. I need to make kiddur, so I need wine. I need to have shalashudah, so I need food. That's why I need you. For security, I don't need you. But the Talmidim of Bilam HaRosh, it's the opposite. He has a chamor. What does he do with a chamor? He plays with a chamor, and he loves the chamor, and he talks to the chamor. He needs that chamor. What for? To get from point A to point B? No. He needs the chamor for company. The Western world that we live in is certainly a world filled with the Talmidim of Bilam. The one indication I told you was the relationship of people to their pets. But one can look at that also in the relationship of people to their motor cars. It's also the relationship with the chamor. You'll see, some people regard a motor car as a means of getting from point A to point B. Some people regard a motor car as a security symbol. That makes them feel secure. It makes them feel that they've achieved it, that they've reached it. And they hock themselves to be able to get that. It's a bilum. That's the chamor. Except instead of a four-legged chamor, we have a four-wheeled chamor nowadays. There's been a little bit of technological progress, but there's been no human progress. It's the same Talmidim of the same Bilam with a different donkey. That donkey died. As soon as he spoke, he died. And the evolution continued, and donkeys became motor cars. And that's what we've got today. But it's the same situation exactly. In the Torah world also, the danger is to find one's fulfillment and one's security from physical things only. That's not sufficient. Doing another mitzvah, learning another Blat Gemara, as important as all that is, that alone is not sufficient to make one feel religiously secure. When Avraham Avinu wants to test these people, two tests. Number one, does the Shekhinah tolerate their presence? That's number one. Number two, if they're great enough for the Shekhinah to tolerate their presence, are they generous with kovet? Generosity of honor, generosity of dignity, that's where you measure the degree of security of an individual. An individual who is free with giving kovet is an individual who feels secure, because he feels within himself that his own kovet is not at stake, that his own kovet cannot be damaged, cannot be taken away by others. His own kovet is something that he's worked for himself and that he's deserved himself. Why? Because he knows his own worth. I have more to give than what I'm worthy of. And having more to give, I feel that honor within myself. Consequently, the more I give, the better it is. And that's where it is. And so we need to understand that as the yeshiva of Avraham Avinu continues, so does the yeshiva of Bilam. But the difference between the two yeshivas are difficult to discern on the surface. If one walks into either yeshiva, one can see the same sort of sight. The test is very subtle. The test is to see how they're relating to one another, the Talmidim relating to one another. If you want to choose a yeshiva, you want to choose a friend, you want to choose a business partner, that's the test. Just see, does he relate to people with kovod, or does he relate to people with meanness? Is he a giver, or is he a taker? If he's a giver, you'll never have an argument with him. No matter how complicated your business relationships with him, or no matter what human difficulties your friendships go through, or your marital relationships go through, if you're examining the possibility of a marriage partner, the same rule applies all the time. Just make sure that your partner, whether for business, friendship, marriage, or whatever, comes from the yeshiva of Avraham Avinu. Just make sure he's a giver, he's not a taker. Make sure that he's generous with his kovod, that he's generous with his honor, and that he's not mean with his honor. With that, you'll be assured that whatever difficulties one encounters in that partnership, those difficulties will be resolved with such ease. Because two people who both want to give, two people who both feel secure, two people who don't feel threatened by one another, can resolve any difficulty. The moment you have insecure people, people who do feel threatened, people who withhold kovod because they think you can store it up like money. If I give kovod, it's like tzedakah, they think. If I give, I've got less. Therefore, I must give less kovod and I'll have more kovod for myself. Who is a truly honored person? One who gives honor, not one who receives honor. The reception of honor is no measure whatever as to who the person is. That's also a mistake that we tend to make very often. Somebody will come in, and one person will stand up, next person, everybody will stand up. All of a sudden, the person is a mechubed. Why is he a mechubed? Who is he? I don't know. So why did you stand up? Because everybody stood up. But who is he? I don't know. He's become honored because he's been given honor. Being given honor is no measure of honorability. A measure of honorability is how he is mechabed, how he gives honor, not how he is given honor. That's the way we measure it. That's the way we measure who we are and what we are.